This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After spending 6.5 years as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam, during which he was interrogated and tortured, Pete Peterson returned to live in Hanoi in 1997, this time as the U.S. ambassador to Vietnam. He's the first U.S. ambassador to Vietnam since the end of the war in 1975, and the first ever to serve in Hanoi. His decision to return has been applauded by some and left others mystified. Now he's the subject of a PBS documentary called Pete Peterson, Assignment Hanoi, which will be broadcast on September 7th. Peterson was flying his 67th bombing mission over North Vietnam when he was shot down and taken prisoner. After his release in 1973, he remained in the military for 8 years, then headed a contracting company and a computer company. From 1990 to 1996, he served in the U.S. House of Representatives as a Democrat from Florida. We called him in Hanoi. Now, why did you want to go back? I think a lot of people would assume that your mind would be filled with nightmarish associations with Hanoi, and the people you'd be living with are the people in whose name you had been tortured. So did you have any reservations about going back? Why did you want to do it?
No, I had well resolved all of those things in my own mind. The reconciliation had taken place. I had visited Vietnam twice prior to coming back on this occasion. And it has played out precisely as I had intended, that the Vietnamese have accepted me. I have worked into this project here and in a very constructive way, and I think it's worked out well for both sides. From the standpoint of memories, they're virtually gone. It's so rare before I have any problems with that it's just not even something to worry about.
You were a bomber. You flew about 67 missions over North Vietnam during the war. Were you concerned that the North Vietnamese would treat you with suspicion because you had bombed their country during the war?
Well, that was my original concern. It was, indeed. But my two previous visits here had somewhat laid some of those back to not being worried too much about it. But at the same time, coming back in a diplomatic circumstance versus my earlier as a member of Congress, I just didn't know how they were going to react to that. And it turned out they have reacted very well and very positively and very supportive of virtually everything I'm trying to do here.
Have you met any of the men who tortured or guarded you when you were in prison? And do you know what they're doing now?
I have met a number of them. I met and interviewed, actually, a former camp commander of one of the camps where I lived and have had the occasion to at least pass a conversation with a couple of the former guards, but not many. I have not sought them out, and they have not sought me out, in fact, so it's just not some experience that I have had here.
What is the appropriate etiquette when, during the course of a day's work as ambassador, you run into, at some kind of function, someone who ran the prison that you were a prisoner in?
It's a circumstance long past. It's a period of time, of course, when we were in combat, and we knew we were in combat. We were still fighting the war the whole time we were here. And so it was just another part of our resistance to work against them, and they, of course, were doing what they were supposed to do, and that's to guard us and to keep us from being effective in causing any disruption in their society. So it was a professional relationship in many ways, even though a very hard one, and it wouldn't bother me to meet any of them at this moment.
The war in Vietnam was fought by the Americans to prevent South Vietnam from being taken over by the communist North, but that's exactly what ended up happening. How does the reality of a communist Vietnam compare to what you thought would happen, the scenario you were fighting to prevent from happening?
Well, things have changed dramatically in this country, and certainly within the systems of this country. Vietnam still is a country undergoing major transition, politically, certainly, economically, without a doubt, and culturally and generationally. So all of those things are different than the time frames that we were looking at this country in the 60s and 70s. It's just, it's not even comparable. The snapshots would never match even in one single piece of the frame. And so it's hard to try to judge what we were thinking then against what we're thinking now, and also at the attitude. When you look at Vietnam today, you're looking at the 12th most populous nation in the world, and of that population, 80 million, 65% are under the age 26. These are young people who essentially want to do the same things as young people all over the world, and that's, you know, reach their potential, get an education, and have a better quality of life. And that's the snapshot of Vietnam today, and it has nothing to do with the 60s or 70s.
So do you find that the younger people, are they indifferent to the war's history, or are they just more open toward Americans, or what?
No, they know about as much of the Vietnam War as an American teenager in a local high school there in America, and that's not much.
Mm-hmm.
They're spending their time studying economics and English and science and doing everything they can to prepare themselves for the emergence of Vietnam into the world stage. And it's going to be successful, primarily because of the energy and the zest that you see in that youthful group.
What aspects of American culture have caught on in Vietnam?
Oh, virtually everything. The Vietnamese, because it's a very young society, you can imagine that they like very much the sort of pop culture that America brings. American music is very, very popular. The Cokes and Pepsis, and now they're getting into some of the fast foods with KFC is here, and they're into bowling. They've got a whole host of things that have America written all over them. And you walk down the street, and you just can't pass a block without seeing multiple T-shirts with American logos and Go Tigers and everything that you can imagine. Just walking around the streets, you have Americana everywhere.
How does the Vietnamese government reconcile people wearing clothes with American business logos on it? How do they reconcile that with a communist socialist state?
Well, actually, I think you need to understand that the communist socialist state is quite different from what maybe a political science major may suggest. The Vietnamese really... you're really hard-pressed to call them pure communist. In fact, in my view, I think communism is dead worldwide. It's just they've used the word. The Vietnamese are clearly socialist nationalist, and frankly, they may have always been. I think they've manipulated the communist relationships they've had with their past partners very well in order to get assistance during the war and then after. I think that the Vietnamese would look at the T-shirts, whether they're a party member or a member of the government or just a local business person, as just part of the way of doing business now. It's not a big deal. It's in fact welcomed, I believe, in most spheres.
What remains of the MIA question? There are still Americans who were missing in action, and their whereabouts have never been determined. There's been a lot of demands to pressure the Vietnamese even more to come up with information about the MIAs. Do you feel that the Vietnamese have done their best in supplying that information?
The Vietnamese are doing quite a lot. In fact, the relationship between the U.S. and the Vietnamese in regard to the MIA question is excellent. I mean, we have made progress in this effort that I wish more Americans really knew about. I don't think we've done a good job in telling the story. In fact, I am calling And I think we are collectively calling the relationship with the Vietnamese on the MIA question a partnership now, more than just cooperation, as we are helping them discover the fate of their 300,000 MIAs, whereby we now have in Vietnam roughly 1,500 persons that we still do not have absolute documentation as to faith. We're continuing to work this issue, and to be honest with you, Terry, this remains our number one issue in working with the Vietnamese. It's something that I spend an inordinate amount of my time on, and we have assigned here experts that are absolutely world-class in dealing with this kind of issue and are making the kinds of investigations that are necessary to discover the fate of these that we have lost. And I think, too, that it should be noted that the commitment on the part of the American side and the Vietnamese side is something that is historic.
Have many MIAs been found since your tenure as ambassador?
Oh, yes. We repatriate the remains of from, it probably averages five a month, or five every other month, I guess it is, because we have our investigations every other month. Overall, since we began this process, we've probably discovered the fate of 500, be my guess, in that ballpark.
How have the remains of men who are MIA been discovered? Did people already have clues in which there were grave sites, or are these just like accidental discoveries?
No, I can assure you they're not accidental. Once in a while, we'll find something like the villagers in the Highlands here last fall gave us a call and said that they had found the remains, and sure enough, we went down and discovered the virtually an entire skeleton, and not only that, but that individual had all of his identification still on him. So we not only had the remains, but we also had essentially instant identification. That was a rare find, obviously. Most of the time, we go back to sites whereby we knew within a few meters, probably, of where the aircraft crashed or where the battle took place or what occurred at such a location. And then we'll actually go back and stake it out, and we'll go through an excavation just like we were going through an excavation for looking for dinosaurs. I mean, it's just it's a very professional process by which we're looking through every little spoonful of dirt for some evidence, and we have been very, very successful in this process.
Is there much of a landmine problem in Vietnam now?
That's, yes,
it's
is.
Become an international controversy, how to deal with that.
Very serious problem. And mostly in the area around the old DMZ, that's really the most critical area.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still areas throughout all of Vietnam where we've dropped munitions, generally airborne munitions, that have not exploded, and that unexploded ordnance is part of the problem that we're calling mine. It's not mine, land mine, as you and I would think of it, but it's largely a problem of unexploded ordnance.
Do you think some of those unexploded ordnances that you might have dropped yourself?
It's not unlikely. It's very possible. It's everywhere. It's really a huge problem. We are, in fact, offering assistance to the Vietnamese in that area, and at this very moment, the Vietnamese are mulling around an agreement that we're trying to get them to sign, essentially, that would bring in trainers and perhaps some more modern equipment from what they have been using to remove those ordinances.
Joining us from Hanoi is Pete Peterson, the U.S. ambassador to Vietnam. He was a POW in North Vietnam for 6.5 years. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pete Peterson. In 1997, he became the first American ambassador to Vietnam since the end of the war in 1975. He's also the first U.S. ambassador to be stationed in Hanoi, which was the capital of North Vietnam. Peterson was a pilot during the war. He was shot down on his 67th bombing mission and held prisoner of war for over 6 years. A documentary about him will be broadcast on public television September 7th. One of the problems that you're trying to address now with a new program is safety. You've initiated or helped to initiate a safety awareness program. You told me before one of the really big problems now is traffic, that a lot of people are getting killed in traffic accidents. What's traffic like in Vietnam now?
It is just catastrophic. It's unbelievable. It's just crossing the street is a great risk, I can assure you. It's one of those things that there is just no one in this country that has any sense about or sensibility about the safety aspects of one's life, and that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to bring to the Vietnamese the understanding that they have to be responsible not only for their life but for all of those around them, which is something that Americans just take for granted, and here. It's just not even considered. They just drive right out in front of you, or walk out in front of you, or place poisons where their children have easy access, or they'll have power lines or essentially running over the top of their bed, or they'll construct walls that are without foundations, and they'll crash in on them and kill people. It just they aren't thinking safety in their everyday life, and we're working very hard to make that a part of our relationship, but at the same time help the Vietnamese government to take this message to the people through their schools and through their media.
About a year ago, you married the woman who heads the Australian Trade Commission in Vietnam. She's Vietnamese, although for many years she lived in Australia. I think she moved there with her family in 1977. This seems to have taken on a much larger symbolic importance in Vietnam, you know, that the American ambassador is married to a woman who is of Vietnamese descent.
Well, it has indeed had a remarkable, brought a remarkable interest on the part of the Vietnamese, I think. And I think all positively. V is just a jewel from the standpoint of having the knowledge of the culture, and also as a professional woman, she essentially is a role model for a lot of the Vietnamese women, too, I'm certain. But she also helps a great deal in my work because she's very sensitive to not only what America is doing and what's to do, but what the international community can do in Vietnam to help them along in developing their economy and to bring them along in the adoption of international standards, all of those things. So, yeah, it's been a wonderful thing to have met and now married her with all of her wonderful attributes, aside from the fact she's quite beautiful and a lovely person to be with.
I have a question about women in Vietnam. During the war in Vietnam, it appeared that there were a lot of women in the North Vietnamese army who were doing the kind of work that women were not doing at that time in the American army. And I think a lot of women in America took notice of that. I'm wondering if that has carried over to life after the war, if women have a place of equality in Vietnamese culture in terms of work and pay and respect.
The Vietnamese women are clearly the major assets in Vietnam. They do 75% of the work, manual labor even, in Vietnam. They control all the money, I'm convinced of that. No Vietnamese family has two pockets where the money is. It's always in the woman's pocket. And they have great power in that respect. On the other hand, they're, from a family point of view, they still are the lesser person in the hierarchy, so to speak. And it's a it's been a difficult challenge for them, but I see them emerging as a much more powerful voice in this country. The very point fact that 26.6% of the National Assembly is made up of women would suggest somewhat of a change in attitudes on the role of women in Vietnam. And we see that essentially every day through commerce and through government offices and the kinds of people we deal with.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Pete Peterson is the U.S. ambassador to Vietnam. A new documentary about him called Assignment Hanoi will be broadcast on public television September 7th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.